Since the Federal Communications Commission is shut down, does that mean I can curse on the air? I mean, I won't, but it's an interesting question. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Wednesday, today the 9th of January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. To be clear, no cuss words today. I actually need this job. But we are going to spend some time on the government of the United States, the partial shutdown thereof, and what is not happening in business and this economy, because that is happening. First of all, big picture. We're a couple of days away from this shutdown becoming the longest shutdown and from the first missed paycheck for those hundreds of thousands of government workers who've been locked out of their jobs. That will be Friday. So, with President Trump saying this after his visit with Republicans on Capitol Hill today.
How long do you want to let this shutdown last, Mr. President?
Whatever it takes.
That was whatever it takes if you couldn't hear it over all the clicking cameras. But with that as the timeline, Marketplace's Sabri Benishour takes us through the shutdown macroeconomic math.
There are 400,000 government workers who have not been working, which means they've not been contributing to GDP. So take their paychecks, which they are not getting, out of GDP, and here's what you get.
We estimate that in the fourth quarter, the impact of the shutdown was to subtract about 0.1% from GDP growth measured at an annualized rate.
Joel Prakken is chief U.S. economist for macroeconomic advisors by IHS Market. The impact in the first quarter of this year will depend on how long the shutdown goes on. It's looking like another 0.1%.
Now, I want to emphasize that these don't necessarily capture the disruption of private commerce, which could get increasingly large the longer the shutdown persists.
A lot of businesses depend on government services. William Gale is with the Brookings Institution.
So if someone's trying to get a business permit, for example, to start construction, do a variety of other things that require government input or government approval, everything is stopped up.
Now, measuring these other effects gets complicated. The family who would have gone to a national park might go watch a movie instead. That doesn't hurt GDP. The workers who don't get paid will probably get back pay later. But the lost government output is never made up. It comes out to about $145 million worth a day, according to IHS Market, or in the space of this story, $150,000. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
So here's what we're going to do the rest of the program. Point out a couple of areas, six, maybe eight, I don't know, I forget, frankly, where the government not being in business could have real trickle-down effects on businesses. We're going to start with housing, even in normal times, a huge chunk of this economy. According to Zillow, the real estate data site, federal workers who aren't going to get a paycheck on Friday will owe almost $500 million in rent or mortgage this month. The National Association of Realtors says about 21% of its realtors have had clients pull out of buying a home, especially if they were trying to get a federally backed mortgage. And don't just take it from me. Here's part of the shutdown FAQ from the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development, itself mostly shut down. Quote, with each day that the shutdown continues, we can expect an increase in the impacts on potential homeowners, home sellers, and the entire housing market. So that's housing. What about Wall Street, the inner workings of Wall Street? I mean, the gears and the gritty stuff, the stuff that the government's supposed to keep an eye on, the part that the Securities and Exchange Commission, shall we say, is responsible for. Here's Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer.
Say you've got a big merger in the works or you're planning to go public like Uber. You need to clear your documents with the SEC for things like the price of your stock, what you're going to tell investors. This usually takes about 6 weeks. But the SEC doesn't want the shutdown to get in the way of business. So it's come up with a shutdown workaround, DIY. It's going to let companies merge and go public without its input. But nobody's going to do that because the SEC seal of approval could be all that's standing between your company and a lawsuit.
Lots of those workarounds happening, by the way, and therein, as Nancy said, lies some peril. The Federal Reserve is working this week. It is not subject to the regular government budgeting process, which means I can tell you this. The central bank released the minutes of its most recent meeting today, the one back in December. 17 pages, lots of charts and graphs. Here is a useful indicator, though. The word trade appeared 17 times in the meetings last month, mostly in a not quite so good context. On Wall Street this Wednesday, the stock trading part, not the regulatory part. Shut down? What shut down? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. More about the shutdown in a minute, but we're going to keep going with trade right now, rolling out of that Fed minutes thing I just did. The U.S. and China wrapped up their first round of negotiations for the new year over in Beijing today. Still lots of differences, of course, and tariffs that are in effect, but the temporary truce on new tariffs is holding. This morning, we called up some of the people we have been checking in with about tariffs the past couple of months to see how they are feeling about the year to come. Ryan Wagner is up first. He's a corn, soybean, and spring wheat farmer in South Dakota.
When we had the tariffs put on our soybean exports to China, that really cut into our market and reduced the cash price that we got for our soybeans. From the peak down to the low, it was $2 to $2.50 of price drop. We'll see what happens here over the course of the next few months, and hopefully we can get something worked out. But also, I think you have to prepare for what happens if we don't get something worked out and we lose that export market. As far as the crop mix on our farm, we're really not changing anything because of the tariffs. Still planning on planting what we normally plant, but if it continues for multiple years, we may have to look at something. But we're hopeful it doesn't get that far.
There is some good news, also some bad news, I guess, for Ryan Wagner and other farmers dealing with the tariffs and the shutdown. You remember that $12 billion in assistance the White House promised? Well, the bad news is that the U.S. Department of Agriculture is partially shut down, so those payments are delayed, and only farmers who've certified their 2018 production levels are going to keep getting those payments once things settle down. The good news is that the USDA extended the application deadline to equal the number of days local offices were closed. This, in case you're counting, is day 19 of the shutdown. 21 is the record. Here's what we know about taxes and the shutdown. First of all, taxes are going to be due as scheduled, of course, and refunds are, in fact, going to be processed for individual filers. But if you're a company, a business in this economy trying to make your way through the first filing season under the new tax code, and the Internal Revenue Service is partially shut down, what do you do? Marketplace's Mariel Segarra is on the tax beat.
There's a skeleton crew at the IRS right now. So companies and their accountants don't know if they're going to get the information they need to file their taxes by the deadline. They don't even know if they'll be able to get somebody on the phone at the IRS who can answer their questions. Right now, nobody picks up when you call the agency's business helpline. And remember, even before the shutdown, this tax season was a scary prospect for companies. We're talking about the biggest change to the tax code in 30 years. The law is 1,000 pages long, and it's still not clear what a lot of it means, especially when it comes to businesses.
So let's talk about immigration and this shutdown, because you can never have too many unintended consequences with your economic news. Border Patrol and Immigration and Customs Enforcement employees are working. They are essential workers, but some businesses that rely on foreign workers are starting to feel the effects all the same. Marketplace's Andy Euler has that one.
A system employers use to verify legal status called E-Verify is not actually functioning right now because of the shutdown. So employers can't be sure about their employees' eligibility to work here. Another thing is that if you hold a visa and your employer tells you to travel to the United States for a conference or to work here, if there's anything wrong with that visa, the staff that would be there to make sure that you're legally supposed to be here isn't essential. So you could be left at customs sort of in limbo.
As I said a minute ago, the December Fed minutes had 17 mentions of the word trade. Here it is used in a sentence. Trade policies and foreign economic developments could move in directions that have significant negative effects on U.S. economic growth. Naomi Wilson knows that all too well. She's the Senior Director for Asia at the Information Technology Industry Council. That's a trade group representing some of the world's biggest tech companies, many of which have been hit by tariffs on electronics and other stuff. She is next up in our trade coverage today.
It's been a few months that we've had the tariffs to deal with, but it's really been over a year that we've had the uncertainty of the dispute and the 301 investigation affecting our companies and their customers. In terms of the reworking of the supply chains and the administration's continued insistence that these products and jobs will come back to the U.S., we're not seeing that. What I hope the administration keeps in mind is that this is a long game. You know, any single action has unintended side effects down the road that we'll be dealing with for years to come.
Coming up.
So there's a lot of historical furniture there that we upkeep, repair, duplicate.
Keeping the halls of Congress fully furnished. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 91 today, 0.3%, 23,879. The NASDAQ found itself 60 points higher, 0.8%, 69.57. The S&P 500, 10 points to the good, 0.4%, 25.84. As we mentioned, the IRS isn't fully staffed, so we'll look at some of the big companies that give tax advice. H&R Block, up 0.9% today. Liberty Tax gave back that same 0.9%. Talked about housing a little bit. So with mortgage lending in mind, Bank of America deposited 0.9%. J.P. Morgan Chase trickled down 0.1%. At airports, of course, with TSA employees working unpaid. How about airlines? United lifted 1.2%. Delta rose more than 2% today. Bonds rose just a touch. That's the price. The yield goes the other way. Yield on the 10-year T-note landed at 2.71%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Having a baby and then going back to work can be hard. Yes, for dads, sure, but hard in a whole different way for moms, especially women who choose to nurse their babies. Natalie Kitchweff from The New York Times, where she covers the economy, has been writing extensively the past couple of months about pregnancy and the American workplace. And just the other day, a big story about breastfeeding and working. Natalie, it's good to talk to you.
Nice to be here.
So give us the opening anecdote of this story. It's a prison in Virginia, right?
Yeah. We start with Susan Van Son, who is a nurse at the prison, who leaves the medical department, walks through 8 locked doors and 1 security checkpoint to her car, finds a breast pump, stuffs a piece of it into her bra and breezes past the security guard on her way back into the prison. And this is part of a plot to bring her manual breast pump into the prison where she works, because the places she's been offered, she finds unacceptable. One of them was the men's restroom outside of the security checkpoint.
Yeah, and not just she finds unacceptable, which are, frankly, ridiculous. And that's kind of the moral of the story, right? It's women working in non-traditional workspaces, prisons, you talk to an airline pilot, a police officer, who are in violation of the law in some cases, not being provided a place to express their breast milk.
That's right. Obamacare made it illegal for employers to deny hourly workers a private place to pump and the time to do so. That didn't cover salaried workers. So when you look at state laws and federal law, that leaves 5 million women without the right to pump at work. So in some cases, you have a whole slew of American women who, you know, are going to great lengths to be able to pump at work because the law doesn't give them that guarantee.
There are a lot of social policy issues wrapped up with this story, not just workplace, right? But the biggest one really is the lack of places to express this breast milk, leading to lower breastfeeding rates because of these workplace restrictions.
I mean, the big picture is that the U.S. also happens to be the only industrialized nation that does not guarantee paid maternity leave. Mm. So you have a situation where women are returning to work in America while they're trying to breastfeed. And when they get there, their employers make it nearly impossible in many cases for them to do so.
This is the latest in a long series of kind of remarkable stories that you've been doing on pregnancy and the workplace and corporations in this economy. And going back, I don't know, 6-8 months, right? And I guess the question is, you never do this coverage, you never do this journalism expecting that things will change, but do you sense that there is receptiveness now to some of these issues as you go out and report?
I do sense that there is a lot of conversation among women at various different rungs of the economic ladder. So women on Wall Street and women in Walmart, about the price that American women pay when they choose to have a baby and they try to keep at the same pace in their career. There have been a number of investigations following our reporting, both, you know, at the congressional and the state level. There's obviously a lot on the plate right now nationally.
Natalie Kitchwef covers the economy for the New York Times. Natalie, thanks a lot. Really good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you.
Among the things the government's not doing during this shutdown, inspecting the domestic food supply. Three little letters, gang, F, D, and A, the furloughed Food and Drug Administration. Marketplace's Renata Sago is on that one.
So the FDA plays a big role in inspecting our food, but it's having to do that with less staff now. That could mean risks for businesses down the line. But if there is an emergency recall, the FDA will send out notices. Here's another thing. When a company wants to bring something new to market, like, say, a dietary supplement, it's got to get that approved by the FDA. But the FDA is not doing that right now. The shutdown also means medical device makers have to wait to get approval to release new products. One more thing. Craft breweries have to jump through a lot of government hoops to open and introduce new drinks. That's on hold, though.
Craft breweries, that's taking it just too far. One man's opinion. Anyway, apologies in advance to Ghostbusters, but we are going to cross the streams of this broadcast right now. Trade and the shutdown. The United States Trade Representative's office is still open, so negotiations with China are still happening, as I said earlier. But Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson does have some other trade issues that aren't going anywhere.
So there are a whole slew of companies that are waiting for an answer from the Commerce Department as to whether or not they'll get an exemption from the steel and aluminum tariffs that are currently in place. They're in limbo as the government shutdown continues. Also, the U.S. International Trade Commission is supposed to be finishing up an economic assessment of the new NAFTA deal, the USMCA. That could be delayed with this shutdown, which could then delay the deal's progress through Congress.
We have had trade and tariffs and soybeans so far, also trade and tariffs and technology. Now trade and tariffs and leather. The leather specialty company in Naples, Florida, makes luggage and other leather goods there, as well as at a factory they've got in the Dominican Republic. And that is where CEO Michael Korchmar was when we got a hold of him this morning.
We're happy with what's going on and hope that progress continues to be made. We're receiving calls daily from customers who are trying not to sound desperate. But are, because they need to find an alternative to China. If we were able to take advantage of all the opportunity, we could increase our business 4 times. The problem is we're unable to ramp up quickly enough to take advantage of it. We're confident that whatever type of trade deal is negotiated, it will be a good one. If the tariffs from which we're benefiting now were to go away, we're confident they will only go away because the access to the Chinese market will become easier. So whatever benefit we enjoy on one side can easily be transferred to the other.
One of the lessons of the government shutdown so far, partial though it may be, is that you don't know what the government really does until it's not doing it anymore. There has been a lot of coverage here and elsewhere of the shutdown parts of the shutdown, but the fact is, most of the government's up and running, so we're going to focus on that right now and take a tour of a place that helps keep the House of Representatives running, but which is well away from public view. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams brings us the almost secret workshops of Congress.
It's the day after Christmas, and teams of movers are rolling through the halls of the Rayburn House office building, just next door to the Capitol. If you were to visit your member of Congress, there's a good chance you'd come here.
And just turn it now, sideways.
That's Mo Rivers, blueprints in hand, directing his crew as they maneuver couches, desks, and bookcases into the office of a new member. The carpet is pristine, the drapes have been cleaned, the smell of fresh paint still hangs in the air. These workers move fast.
We can come in, lay carpet, paint, and have it set up the next day, overnight.
There's no time to waste. It's going to take more than 275 moves to get the new Congress, committees and all, into place. A lot of what happens up here depends on what happens below, in the labyrinth of tunnels under Capitol Hill, where a couple hundred craftsmen keep thousands of pieces of congressional furniture and equipment in working order.
It's a good central location where we can get to things quickly and move things around quickly.
Tom Coyne is the chief logistics officer for the chief administrative officer of the House. There's a DC title for you. He's in charge of making sure every member of the House has a fully functioning office with a sense of history.
And all the shops are in this corridor here.
The shops he's talking about are the workshops, where master craftsmen, some who've been here for decades, build new furniture and restore hundreds of desks, cabinets, chairs, and coffee tables, some of which have been around since Teddy Roosevelt was in power.
The Capitol is a working museum, so there's a lot of historical furniture there that we upkeep, repair, duplicate, replicate.
Darren Dahlstrom manages the cabinetry workshop. Most of the furniture in member offices has been through here at some point. His team also makes one-of-a-kind pieces likely destined for museums themselves. Dahlstrom is particularly proud of an intricate 20-foot table he built when John Boehner was Speaker of the House.
Sapele is a type of wood used, and it's bordered with a short grain of English yew, and it's a very beautiful table. It resides in the Speaker's office in their conference room right now.
Then there's the ornately carved lectern House members use when they give speeches on the floor.
Yeah, all the carvings were done by a couple of gentlemen in here. And some of the metal work inside I've taken home and welded with my own welder at home. And everybody's had a little hand in it.
These craftsmen often put in 10, 12-hour days when there's a lot of turnover after an election. In the same corridor below Rayburn, I find Mike Dean at the sewing machine stitching drapes for Speaker Nancy Pelosi's new office. The old fabric.
It was more of a darker brown, and now it's going to a lighter oyster.
There's an iconic red leather tufted chair just a few feet away. There were once hundreds of these Turkish chairs in House offices. Half the leather on this one has been removed, revealing the coils and stuffing.
It's going to have new leather. That's going to be the only difference in the way than that it was bought in the 1900s. I'm still going to have the coil springs, the horsehair, the hand stitching.
Wait, horsehair?
We do have a stash of horsehair. We reuse it out of all the old furniture.
Old as in the 1800s and 1900s, before foam took over.
We have a hair picking machine. I can show it to you if you want to see it.
Yeah, I do. Dean takes me across the hall past rolls of carpet and giant cutting tables to one of the last fully functioning horsehair picking machines in the world. Dean feeds in a clump of stuffing, and the machine quickly spits out a cloud of teased out horsehair.
It takes it all matted down and just fluffs it up.
So it can be stuffed back into a chair that will go back into a House office, where Dean hopes it will stay for at least 35 years before making its way back down here. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, you might have seen that Jeff Bezos, the CEO of Amazon, and his wife Mackenzie are getting a divorce. I say we leave him alone. All right, we got to go. Thanks for sticking around. The Dow is up 91 points today, 0.3%. The NASDAQ found itself 60 points higher, about 0.8%. S&P 500 up 10 points, 0.4%. Sarah Brugger, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.